May it please the Court. I will apologize in advance. I will probably refer to myself as respondent and them as appellant because that's what I'm used to, but I try really hard not to do that. The defendant in this case, Mr. Richard, upon learning that his wife intended to leave him, told her that he would kill himself by blowing his head off, and that if she called the police, he would go outside with a gun and make the police shoot him. The defendant then took an unknown amount of morphine and an unknown amount of amitriptyline, and he armed himself with a fully loaded Beretta 9mm semi-automatic handgun and a shoulder holster containing a fully loaded spare clip for the Beretta, which would seem to indicate that he intended to do more than shoot himself. When the police arrived, the defendant was in an unconscious state, seated in a chair in his residence with the loaded gun in his lap and the extra clip in his shoulder holster.
Was he unconscious or was he asleep?
Well, this is part of the problem we have, Your Honor, is we didn't get to have a trial. And so according to the probable cause statement, he was unconscious, is my understanding. Now, if he was in fact just asleep, this could certainly be an argument that he could have raised at trial to say that he was not in fact intoxicated, that he had merely fallen asleep, and that therefore he was not under the influence of the morphine and the amitriptyline. But as we did not get to take the case to trial, those facts have not been fully developed, so we really don't know.
And does it make a difference? I mean, when you look at the definition of the word possess or possessed in the statutes under 556, it says having actual or constructive possession of an object with knowledge of its presence. If you're intoxicated or asleep, you really have knowledge of the presence of the firearm.
Well, you certainly do have knowledge of the presence of the firearm. If you picked up the firearm before you fell asleep or before you became unconscious, you know that you possessed that firearm and then you subsequently became unconscious, but you were in possession of it at the time while you were intoxicated. So, yes, you would have knowledge of it. Now, if you had a situation, for example, where the person fell asleep and his wife snuck over and put the gun in his lap and snuck over and put the ammo in his shoulder holster, which, of course, we have no idea if that happened, then he'd have an argument that I didn't have knowledge. I didn't have knowledge that I had this. But, of course, we don't know that. Our understanding, again, we didn't get a chance to develop the facts in this case because we didn't get to go to trial. My understanding would be that, yes, he did have knowledge because he armed himself with the weapon and with the ammunition before he became unconscious.
Is this similar to the kind of cases we have where people either are sleeping or they pass out in a car on the side of the road and it's not operating? And I think we've held that's operating a motor vehicle. I mean, it's not running, and they're just there on the side of the road. I think we've held they're operating a motor vehicle while they're intoxicated, or like a boat, in the middle of a lake, and you've got a lot of alcohol in the middle of a lake. They can come up, and if there's like, that's just, you know, there's assumed that you're operating that vehicle,
certainly,
even though you're not.
Certainly.
Even though you're running.
And you're not just charging that he had it while he was unconscious. He had it before he was unconscious.
Sure, certainly.
It was the possession the time he took it into possession.
Right. The statute goes on to say a person has constructive possession if such person has the power and the intention at a given time to exercise dominion or control over the object. My point is that this statute's purpose is to protect the public from a person who has a firearm that, and they're in an intoxicated state and could harm someone else or themselves. If this person is asleep or passed out, how is he in the position to harm himself or others?
Because, Your Honor, before he passed out, before he fell asleep, well, before he passed out, before he became unconscious, because that's our understanding of what happened here, is he took the drugs and he overdosed on the drugs. Again, I don't know that because we didn't have the trial. But he would have been intoxicated before he became unconscious, and he was in possession of the gun at that time. He was a risk at that time. He would also be a risk, Your Honor, if he woke up from the unconscious state. He would probably still be in an intoxicated state. It's the same situation as if you had somebody behind the wheel of a car. They're intoxicated. They drive the car to a certain spot. They become unconscious behind the wheel. We don't wake them up and say, hey, it's okay for you to drive on. Go on now. Go on home. There's still a risk because they're still intoxicated.
It's the same circumstance as if he had the gun while he was intoxicated. He paraded around with the gun, and then he took the gun and put it down. Even though by the time the police arrived, he didn't have it in his possession. He still had it and was at a prior time.
Well, yes, and he did have it in his possession,
that's
Your Honor,
true.
Because it was in his lap. It was in his lap, and the ammo was on his shoulder. So this is clearly a weapon that was in his possession.
Yeah, so we look at this case as on the facts here, we don't look at facially unconstitutional about some other issues that might come up. It's just basically on the facts before us. Could he have been in this?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that was
Didn't the trial judge find that it was unconstitutional on its face? I mean, I can understand why you would want us to maybe look at the second issue, but both issues are preserved, correct? Applied to this gentleman, but also the trial court found, I believe, that it was unconstitutionally vague.
The trial court found that it was unconstitutionally vague, but, excuse me, the trial court erred in doing so because the trial court, in making that determination, was relying on facts that were not before the court and was not applying the proper constitutional analysis. The proper constitutional analysis, again, statutes are presumed constitutional and will not be invalidated unless they clearly and undoubtedly violate constitutional law. The burden is on the person, in this case the defendant, challenging the law to prove that it clearly and undoubtedly violated the Constitution. What happened below was, instead of pointing to the facts of that case, what the defendant did and what the trial court relied on were hypothetical sets of facts that were not remotely at issue in this case, and based on those hypotheticals, the court decided, well, I think that this is unconstitutional. Essentially, what the court did was apply the overbreath doctrine, but the overbreath doctrine is not applicable here because the overbreath doctrine is only applicable in First Amendment context, and this is not a First Amendment issue. The overbreath doctrine should not be applied, and therefore the trial court applied the wrong standard when it was analyzing the constitutionality of this statute.
And that's the Papa Cristo case.
Pardon me?
That's the Papa Cristo versus Gainesville case.
Yes.
About the overbreath First Amendment.
Can you also address your argument? One of the key arguments of opposing counsel is that it would permit someone, if we did look more broadly or even at him, he would be liable under the statute if he just got drunk and he happened to have the weapon in his house because he would constructively possess it at that time, even if he were not in his home. And your argument is that it has to be readily accessible.
Yes, Your Honor. Under the statutory language of, I believe it's, hang on here just a second. Well, under section 571.031, I believe it's 5. I'd have to pull out my brief to be sure because I don't have it in front of me. The plain language of the statute, this is a separate section of the statute, says that subparagraph, point three states that point 1.3 and 5 does not apply unless the weapon is readily accessible. And a weapon is not going to be readily accessible if, for example, I'm passed out in my chair and my gun is over in my gun cabinet. It is not readily accessible.
Now, opposing counsel says it only applies when you're transporting a weapon and doesn't apply more broadly.
Appellant misreads the statute.
Well, and also the reason the gun would be in the home would be for self-defense purposes, which is clearly excluded from the statute.
Now, following up with Judge Fisher's questions, given the Heller case, do you have any cases that say we cannot apply the Second Amendment and say it's facially unconstitutional like the First Amendment? I know there's a long line of cases of the First Amendment. What about the Second? Are there any cases?
Regarding the Second Amendment and its applicability here, the Second Amendment has never been found applicable to the states. There is one case that I know of, which is the Tenth Circuit case, which is the Nordyke case, and they found that the Second Amendment is applicable to the states. That case has been, they're rehearing that case en banc.
But that's of no particular use to us because the Missouri Constitution is more.
Right. I mean, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's more clearly written than the Second Amendment.
Right. And it really doesn't matter whether this court should find the Second Amendment applicable or not. Could you? Sure, I suppose you could, but you don't have to, and it's not going to affect. As far as the state is concerned, we don't think that would affect at all how this case should come out. I mean, actually, I mostly just pointed it out just for interest's sake because I didn't know the Second Amendment wasn't applicable to the states until I started working on this case. You all probably knew that, but I did not.
Our state constitution is 35,000 words long, so we've got a lot more applicability in the state constitution than federal.
We've got everything covered from guns to bingo, Your Honor, so yes.
That's right.
We're covered.
And the Heller case came out of the District of Columbia. That's why it's still
right, and that's why the Heller case is different, because it was analyzing a law in the District of Columbia, not a state, and so it was analyzing federal law, and so that's why Heller doesn't really affect the analysis here either.
So what you're requesting is that we remand for a trial where the issues of whether or not the weapon was readily accessible and whether he was intoxicated and knowingly possessed it can be determined?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. Okay. Unless there are any other questions about anything.
Thank you. Well, just one question just to make sure that I really understand your position. As it relates to preservation of the issues, though, both issues are before this court, whether or not it's overbroad or unconstitutionally vague and as applied to this particular defendant.
I think it is, Your Honor. The court's decision below is not particularly clear, neither is there, you know, but I think ultimately when I analyzed it, I decided that, yes, the court ultimately decided both.
Mm-hmm. Because the remedy may be different depending upon those assertions, correct?
Well, the problem I see with this, Your Honor, as far as whether we're looking at this as facially invalid or invalid as applied to him, if we're talking about invalid as applied to him, we're really not in a position where we can make that.
I agree. So my question is, what's the real remedy if this court would find that it was unconstitutionally vague? I mean, are you suggesting that? Because it seems like to me, if you had to try all these cases to determine if a statute was unconstitutionally vague, none of them would ever be granted on a motion to dismiss. And the constitutionality of a criminal statute could really never be challenged on its face without a trial.
If you're not talking about a First Amendment law, then I think that's correct, Your Honor. And we're not talking about a First Amendment law here. We got to do it on the facts. My time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnston, do you agree that the trial court's order and judgment covers both facial unconstitutionality and a finding that it's unconstitutional as applied?
I believe it does. particularly the facially unconstitutional, I believe that it covers that that it would be overbroad. For instance, and in a situation
other than the Bainey case, is there any case anywhere that applies the overbreadth doctrine outside the First Amendment?
Well, actually, there's some United States Supreme Court cases in the areas of abortion, contraception, travel. There are a couple of more that, although the Supreme Court at times has said we've only held that it applies in the First Amendment, in actuality, they have applied it outside of
in the penumbra.
Does the fact that this man was arrested in his home, that the offense was committed in his home, is that central to your argument or is that just an incidental?
I do believe it's central to the argument.
So if he were sitting on a park bench with a gun in his lap, passed out or whatever, it would be a different case.
If he was out on the streets in knowing possession of a firearm while in intoxicated, I believe it would be a different fact situation.
So you're arguing that there's a right to be drunk in your home with a gun?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say drunk, substantially impaired. I think you could have a couple of drinks or
well, I'll give the prosecution its due. We take their pleadings as they're made. They said he was intoxicated.
Well, he was under the influence of a prescribed medication.
Well, whatever. Yeah,
and so I believe that he has a right. I believe a gun owner has a right to take prescribed medications in their house while the gun is readily accessible. It does no good to defend yourself if the gun's not readily accessible.
Well, but you have the right to self-defense in your home. That's an entirely separate provision. So if this court says that applies in your home, but there's no suggestion here he was using it in self-defense. He said he was going to blow his head off, and if the police came, he was going to make him shoot him, and he went out, sat in the porch with the gun across his lap. That's not self-defense.
Right, but you're allowed to keep your gun in anticipation of self-defense.
But he's not been charged with the state acknowledges that the statute specifically says that. So I'm not clear why being in the home is any different if the state acknowledges that it has to be readily accessible and that you have a right to self-defense in your home. It's charging him for different reasons.
I just believe that the courts have recognized that there are extra protections that you get whenever you're
at. But tell me why those apply here in light of the state's acknowledgments and in light of the language of the statute that says you have a right of self-defense, you can keep a weapon in your home for self-defense, and in light of subsection 3's statement that it has to be readily accessible.
Well, the statute actually, the two exceptions are that it's readily accessible and that if you're engaged in the act of self-defense.
Well, there's no issue of self-defense in this case.
No, there's not, but I think still there doesn't have to be if this court applies the overbreadth doctrine, for instance, because if the statute's unconstitutional to a substantial number of cases, it doesn't matter whether or not those same circumstances
to find a statute facially unconstitutional, we have to find that there's no set of circumstances under which this statute would be valid. And can't you think of one set of circumstances that this statute could be valid? If a person walked in the courtroom right now intoxicated with a gun, wouldn't that be a perfect valid situation for the statute?
Well, first of all, if the overbreadth doctrine applies, you do not use the no set of circumstances test because it's an exception. If overbreadth applies, if it applies under the facts of this case,
what if overbreadth does not apply?
If overbreadth does not apply, I believe that the no set of circumstances exception, it's called the Salerno test. And actually, the United States Supreme Court in the city of Chicago versus Morales has said that has never been our test for facial invalidity. And it certainly doesn't apply to the states are not required to.
But it's certainly the test that we've applied here in Missouri.
We have, but I would suggest, in citing Salerno, but I would argue that if you apply that type of test, then as a practical matter, there is no such a thing as a facial invalidity. Because if it applies in all cases, then the defendant would just do as applied.
That's sort of the concept of restraint. That's sort of the concept of restraint in reaching out and not reaching out and taking issues in cases that aren't before us.
Well, normally, except for the overbreadth doctrine, like in the Viney case, you can, because otherwise what happens is gun owners are put in a position to where they have to risk violating the law in order to be protected.
I'm sorry, but related, because I was trying to ask you earlier, what is it you're saying you're discouraging? Because the overbreadth doctrine in the First Amendment context, we don't want to discourage people from speaking for fear that they'll later on be prosecuted or sued. What conduct are you saying is
That you can drink and take medicine in your own house.
So if we read the statute as saying that you have the right to self-defense, that has to mean you have a right to have a gun in your house. I'm unclear how it would your overbreadth argument would even apply.
Well, except for under the statute, if you're not engaged in the act of self-defense, and most of the time.
Well, I understand, but if we don't read it that way to be say you can engage in self-defense in your home, you have to have something to defend yourself. So implicit in it is you can have a gun in your home.
Right, but
even if you're off at a party drunk or downstairs drunk.
But I think the way the statute is worded, if the weapon is readily accessible, you would be guilty under the statute.
But it all depends on what I'm trying to get to is your overbreadth argument depends on our interpretation of that self-defense language in the statute. And if it's interpreted broadly, then that would undercut your argument.
Well, I think in order to interpret it that way, you would have to redefine the statute because the way possession is defined and the way intoxicated is defined, it would not cover all those situations.
Well, let me, all this constitutional theory is making my head hurt, but the guy has a right, I assume, to possess a firearm.
Correct.
And so the question about and having a firearm in your home, I assume, means possession.
If it's readily accessible.
I mean, he's got it in a gun case. He is.
He's possessing.
Possession.
If he knows about it, certainly.
And I guess he's got a right to intoxicate himself in his home. So then the question really comes up.
All those things aside, did the police have a right to be there? Because you're talking about the setting of his home, and they did because his wife called them.
Well, certainly there's no, for the record, it doesn't appear that there are any Fourth Amendment concerns because the wife invited the police inside the home. That's correct.
So I suppose this is the tree falling in the forest. If nobody hears it, does there a sound? If the cops aren't there, he can be drunk in his home and he can have a firearm in his home.
It's true that most of the time the police would not know about the fact that you had a weapon readily accessible while
So the protection that you're really talking about, it seems to me, and here I go with some constitutional doctrine against my better judgment, is the Fourth Amendment.
No, I still think, I mean, as it turns out, while in most cases we don't know that the person is in technical violation of the statute, the
but
person
the
still would
do
be
not
in
have a right to come to your house and invite themselves in to see if you're drunk and have a weapon.
Well, I guess in theory the police wouldn't have to be there. You could have the wife make a complaint. Go to the police and say, my husband was in the house and there was a firearm readily accessible. So you wouldn't have to have the police in there. You could have anybody in the household.
So the next time somebody goes to a party and the homeowner gets loaded and he happens to have a gun, he should call the police the next day and turn him in.
So what he's saying is readily accessible, because probably holding a gun intoxicated in the middle of a party is somewhat dangerous if you're not using it in self-defense. I don't think that's what we want to protect.
No, but for instance, I think the statute would criminalize, for instance, let's say you took some medication, you had some sort of surgery, you take medication, you're in a rough neighborhood, you have a firearm and a table next to the bed in case somebody comes in.
And it's your position that despite the statement in sub 5 that should not apply to persons who are engaged in a lawful act of
defense. But you're not engaged in self-defense because nobody's actually come in and done anything.
So that even though you could pull it out and use it legally, it can't be in the drawer legally, is your reading of the statute.
Right. I mean, that's exactly what the statute reads. It says that the firearm, if it's readily accessible, and it would. Well, let's say, for instance, you heard a noise and you picked it up out of the thing.
Then you're okay.
Turned out there was nobody. Well, you would be guilty because technically you are not engaged in the act of self-defense. You don't have a right to defend yourself at that point in time against an unknown assailant. I mean, it may be defense of property, but the statute doesn't actually accept the defense of property either. In other words, it doesn't say you can use you cannot be prosecuted using the firearm to defend your property. The actual words in the statute are that you're actually engaged in the act of self-defense. But the Missouri Constitution doesn't only protect the right to bear the arms, but also to keep the arms. And the only reason you would want to keep the arm is if it's readily accessible. In other words, it's not going to give you much of a defense.
And why, for that reason, is it not implicit in saying you can use it in self-defense, that of course you have to have it to be able to use it, so it's implicit that it's okay to have it there for that purpose?
Well, I believe that if you have a gun in your house in a cabinet or in an area where it's readily accessible, I don't believe you're actually engaged in the act of self-defense. Okay. I can be in the house.
I understand.
But you're not actually involved in that activity. I guess the points I would like to make is, first of all, I believe that we don't need to know the facts of the case if the overbreadth doctrine applies. And under this court's case in Bainey, it doesn't necessarily have to apply to First Amendment. And I believe that the statute does criminalize innocent activities, while it may be difficult to prove. And I also believe that even if the overbreadth doctrine doesn't apply, because we're dealing with a fundamental right of the right to bear your arms, then you would involve a strict scrutiny type test, and there has to be a compelling state interest narrowly drawn, and I don't believe the statute.
Now, that the U.S. Supreme Court didn't say that. They simply said it wasn't a rational basis, but they really carefully didn't say what it was.
They didn't say, but I believe they also, entirely through the opinion, they kept equating the Second Amendment with the First. They kept saying, the Second Amendment, just like the First Amendment, And they did that, I'd say, at least on four or five occasions during the opinion. What's certain, and they also, not only did they reject the rational basis, but they also rejected Justice Breyer's interest.
Now, we're not dealing with federal law, but you mentioned abortion cases. That line of cases comes from Brandeis's Harvard number one law review, and Griswold case and his dissent in the 1920s, and that's all First Amendment law. Griswold versus Connecticut is all, that all comes from the First Amendment.
It's, but not, there's also some 14th Amendment cases that have applied.
Right, 14th Amendment applies it.
Well,
as Judge Sitz said, penumbra, or some people call it a consolidation principle. But
right. And certainly this court has applied it in the Bainey case, and then I guess after the Bainey case, there was the Bergen case that the Eastern District had that this court.
Well, the Bainey case was a close vote, but the guy was actually arrested, and he had a trial.
It had two grounds, and that was a second ground, but it found that the statute didn't apply to him, so that was really dicta, wasn't it?
No, I don't believe it was dicta. In fact, in the Eastern District, subsequently in the Bergen case, specifically reversed that defendant's conviction based on an overbreadth analysis, citing Bainey. The Eastern District transferred the case up to this court. This court heard argument and retransferred the case.
My dissent from Bainey may be showing.
But what's that? I'm sorry.
That I dissented in Bainey may be showing.
That's true. You did dissent in Bainey. But I think you also argued that under the facts of that case, that there was really no constitutionally protected acts. Mm-hmm.
Can the statute be interpreted to say engaged in self-defense, to cover the circumstances that you're worried about, that you're just there and you have it in your possession and it's readily available, but not cover this circumstance where there is some additional conduct that shows the person is not engaged in self-defense, that he is engaged in has some other purpose, and so that it doesn't cover all of the circumstances that would be genuine possession for self-defense, but not cover where clearly there is evidence that found to be true that that's not what he was doing.
I believe that you really cannot read self-defense that broadly. The Constitution protects the right to defend your property also, not just your person, but you're also your property. And the statute doesn't provide an exception to the defense of your property. And so I believe that when it uses the words engaged in self-defense, that you would have
So in effect, you're saying any law that deals with guns, if there's any conceivable set of circumstances where it could be invalid, we have to throw it out.
No, I don't believe that. I believe that it has to, at least if it affects a substantial and a number of cases, you would have to under the overbreadth doctrine. But I don't believe nitpick and find one particular hypothetical fact situation that's unlikely to ever occur, that it would necessarily, but I don't think that the statute is that narrow.
Are there no further questions? Thank you very much.
Now, Ms. Kramer, since there was no trial, and so the facts weren't developed in trial, really the convicting him of a crime would be very difficult. But if we could decide it's not facially unconstitutional, then we have a two-pronged decision. Well, we can't really find him guilty of a crime because he never was tried.
Well, no, we're not asking. If I'm understanding what you're saying, we're not asking.
But you're not asking for that.
No, all we're asking is that the case be remanded so that we can take the case to trial. That's all we're asking.
Sure.
Because the court below didn't even let us do that because they say that it's unconstitutional on its face. We're saying you can't find the statute unconstitutional on its face. You should not be applying the overbreadth doctrine in this case. It's absolutely inapplicable in this case. And if the overbreadth doctrine isn't applicable, then this statute stands because you have to find that there's no set of circumstances where this statute could be applicable. You have to find that's the standard. The overbreadth doctrine is an exception. It is not the rule. It is an exception. And it was an exception that was created for the First Amendment rights, and that's because of the special nature of First Amendment rights. First Amendment rights, if you look at them, they are inherent to being human. The right to speak, the right to have thoughts and express opinions, the right to associate with other human beings, the right to practice a religion or not practice a religion, as the case may be. These are part, they're inherent to being human. The possession of firearms, while it's an important right and it's a constitutional right, it is not inherent to the actual human condition, which is what you have in the First Amendment. And that's why we have the overbreath doctrine, to protect the First Amendment rights so they are not impermissibly chilled. We're not talking about that kind of right with the Second Amendment right, nor are we talking about chilling the right to get drunk in one's home, nor are we talking about chilling the right, if there is such a right, nor are we talking about chilling the right to take prescription drugs.
It's more of an opportunity than a right.
More than that, exactly. You know, the fact of the matter is, I took 5 prescription drugs this morning. I'm not well. 5 prescription drugs and 1 over-the-counter drug. And but for the fact that I'm standing in this courtroom right now, it would be perfectly permissible for me to possess a gun. Absolutely perfectly permissible, because I'm not intoxicated.
How do we get around the language in Bainey that apply the overbreath doctrine?
I believe that first of all, Bainey, or however we're supposed to pronounce it, it doesn't stand as a requirement that you have to apply it in this case. It is dicta in that case, as Judge Stith said, because what this court had already done, this court had found that there was insufficient evidence to uphold the conviction. There was absolutely no reason to reach the constitutional issue. The other problem with the analysis in that case is the court in Bainey relied on cases saying, well, Kerr cases where they applied it in a non-First Amendment case, well, but they actually were First Amendment cases. One of them was expressly a First Amendment case, and this is in my reply brief. He's attacking his First Amendment right to freedom of speech and freedom to associate. The other case involved the same kind of law, and although it didn't specifically say it was a First Amendment case, it certainly wouldn't.
It also had nothing to do with the Second Amendment. It had to do with sexual offenses and how broadly they could ban what could also be innocent conduct, and there was a concern about that. Nothing to do with this kind of situation or being intoxicated or any of the issues in this case.
That's correct. So I don't think that this court has to worry at all about Bainey and being any kind of requirement that it has to apply the overbreath doctrine in this case. It's simply not applicable.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.